Support for IPR comes from Orchestra Iowa, presenting the movie E.T., the extraterrestrial on the big screen, accompanied by the Symphony Orchestra performing the score live, May 3rd and 4th at 7:30 at the Paramount. Tickets at orchestraiowa.com.
It's River to River from IPR News. I'm Ben Kiefer. 5 months ago today, on October 7th, Hamas launched a surprise attack on southern Israel from the Gaza Strip. Over 1,200 Israelis and foreign nationals were killed. Hamas took some 250 hostages. After clearing Hamas militants from its territory, the Israeli military embarked on an extensive aerial bombardment of the Gaza Strip. That was followed by a large-scale ground invasion with a stated aim to eliminate Hamas as a threat. Since then, over 30,000 Palestinians have died in the conflict, many thousands of them women and children. A horrific humanitarian crisis in our news has developed. Healthcare in a state of collapse, shortages of food, clean water, medicine, fuel due to the blockade, electricity and communications, blackouts, and famine conditions. The Biden administration has become increasingly blunt in recent days in pressing Israel and Hamas to come to terms for a ceasefire that would last at least 6 weeks and would facilitate the release of dozens of hostages. The conflict has reverberated around the world and has prompted passionate protest from many different voices here in Iowa as well. For instance, Monday night, outside the Cedar Falls City Hall, a group of nearly two dozen protesters called for a ceasefire and voiced their frustration with their government's inaction. Activists thought they had scored a major victory in January when the Cedar Falls City Council considered a resolution condemning the violence, but that has since been withdrawn in part because the conflict, according to some officials, to use their words, isn't the city's business. IPR reporter Grant Leo Winterer was at the meeting. He spoke with the head of the Cedar Falls Human Rights Commission, Sonia Balk. She says Cedar Falls should be concerned about the conflict.
So in this area to the south of us is, you know, Iowa City, where there's a major university. And then here at Cedar Falls, we have a major university as well. And then we have John Deere. So we definitely have global industry as well. So I think we have a vested interest in global human rights. Part of the city here, from what I understand, their resistance was is they don't think it's city business. But, you know, I've heard the most intellectual and intelligent arguments like, well, this is a global world, right? And, you know, if things happen globally, like John Deere, what if they lose some contracts? So it would affect the city. And like many people said, our taxes are going to help fund what's going on.
Sonia Balk, head of the Cedar Falls Human Rights Commission. Today on our program, several views on the war from Iowans. Later, a Palestinian-American, we'll hear from her. She lives in the Quad Cities. Also from the former head of Hillel at the UI. First, let's try to understand the history that led to the October 7th terrorist attack and ongoing war. Earlier today, I spoke with Bob Cargill, the Roger A. Hornsby Associate Professor in Classics at the University of Iowa. He's a biblical studies scholar and specializing in ancient Jewish history. Bob Cargill, welcome back to our program.
It's good to be here, Ben. Thanks for having me.
Before we get to the history of this conflict, later in the hour, I mentioned, we'll hear from a Palestinian-American, from a Jewish-American. What is your position on this war? Are you an advocate for one side or the other?
So I teach this conflict in my classes. I teach ancient origins of religious conflict. I'm actively teaching this conflict in my course right now at the University of Iowa. And last semester, I was teaching a history of Jerusalem as this conflict broke. And so I basically teach this conflict every semester. And I try to shoot it right down the middle. I have Palestinian friends. I have Israeli friends, Muslim friends, Jewish friends, and I've been digging in Israel. Right, I've been there. I've had one of these
archaeological digs.
Yeah, archaeological digs in Israel. And I was there in Hatzor in 2006 when one of these Qassam rockets went off right near me, and the concussion, you know, blew me into the trunk of my own car. So I've had, not like the Israelis, not like the Palestinians. I don't try to equate myself to that at all. But I have been over there when these wars break out. It is not fun, and I have friends over there whose kids are in the military, whose families are being affected by this. And so I try to take a balanced approach and can tell people that both sides have legitimate grievances here.
Mm-hmm. You teach biblical studies, ancient Jewish history. Can you trace for us the roots of this conflict in the short time that we have?
Sure.
How far back do we need to go to get a grasp on this history of this war, and why does it matter how far back you go?
If you've ever been in a fight with a sibling, a brother or a sister, and you're arguing in the back of the car, or you're fighting with each other on the couch, and one slugs the other on the arm, and you say, "Okay, no more punching, starting now," right? And you're like, "Well, that's not fair," and so you punch them back, and "Okay, not starting now." It's that whole starting now scenario that people like, that both sides do to one another. The conflict goes all the way back, right? This is Palestine. This is the Eastern Mediterranean coast. And who are the indigenous people of this land? It's the Canaanites. And who were the Canaanites? Well, we know the names of some of them, Ugarit and Phoenicia and these Canaanite tribes. And some of those tribes are these Israelites. And we have this from a 13th century inscription. We have them from Egypt claiming to conquer these people, Israel. We've got them there named. So they're there way back. They have a kingdom. We have them mentioned in the Bible, but also outside of the Bible. So ancient Israel's an entity. They're there. And the reason it's important to mention that is there are Palestinians today who talk about temple denial. They talk about this, that doesn't count. They had a kingdom. They were driven out of it by the Babylonians. They came back. They had another kingdom under the Hasmoneans. They were driven out of it. And so this is their indigenous homeland. But in the 7th century, with the rise of Islam, the Arab tribes came off the Arabian Peninsula and took over this land. And they've been there ever since, until the Ottoman Empire rose up and controlled this land. They controlled Egypt. They controlled, what is now modern Turkey. And so the Ottomans were the ones that were in control. And they happened to be in control when we made this shift from empires at the end of the 19th century to states. Everybody was into making states now, and we were getting away from empires. So the British Empire is in decline. The French, were getting rid of their colonial holdings. And everybody was into forming states. And that's where we need to look at this. The Ottomans controlled Palestine. They controlled Egypt. And that's where we actually need to begin the discussion.
So when you hear the claim, the statement that the Jews are the colonizers and the Palestinians are the indigenous people, you say,
there were always Jews living in the Ottoman Empire. There were always Jews living in Palestine. And by the way, with the rise of this nationalism in Europe, in the 19th century, with the rise of these states being formed, and all the empires collapsing, there was Jewish immigration to Palestine. This is called secular Zionism. This was taking place in the late 19th century. If you look up the Sursok land purchases, Jews were coming, taking up money, and were buying up land from the Ottomans. This is before the British Mandate. They were buying up land, especially in what is now northern Israel, long before the British got there, when the Ottomans still controlled. They were buying it from the Ottomans. They were buying land from the Arabs. This was legal land purchases. So there was a wave of Zionism, of Jews wanting to go back to their ancestral homeland long before World War I, long before the British ever got there.
Biblical studies scholar Bob Cargill with us. Bob, we have to take a break in a couple minutes, but before we do, we have time. I'd like to have you, we'll hear from a Palestinian American and Jewish American in just a few minutes. How would you sum up how each side sees this conflict, building on what you said, the historical roots of it?
I think from a Palestinian point of view, they see, look, we've been living here, since the 8th, 9th century. They can trace their back to when the Arabs conquered Palestine back in the 7th century with the rise of Islam. And some of them can trace their, we've been here for 1,400 years. And they don't care so much that the British took that British mandate and gave 75% of it to create an Arab state in Transjordan. They created this Arab state of Iraq. You've seen Lawrence of Arabia, right?
Mm-hmm.
The British went and recruited Arab leaders to try to get them to help them defeat the Ottomans. And so as a reward, they said, we're going to give you this Arab state. They wanted a state. And so they gave them Jordan, Transjordan. This is 75% of the mandate, and Iraq. But the Arabs living in Palestine, living in what is now Israel in the West Bank, they say, yeah, but we don't want to move over there to have our Arab state. We've been living here for generations. We want the Arab state here. And then the Jews, who've been promised this state or have been encouraged and have been moving, migrating, immigrating back to this area of land, their ancestral homeland, they've been saying, well, the British told us we could have a state here too. And so the Palestinians say, no, the British, you know, basically double-crossed us. They told us we could have a state here, and now it's the state of Israel. We can't have that. We don't want a sovereign Israeli state. We don't want a Jewish state. We don't want to live next to these folks. Remember, they were attacking the Jews before there was a state of Israel. That's why they came up with the Peel Plan and the partition plan. Mm-hmm. They wanted to try to put down these riots between Arab villages and these Israeli villages. That's the Palestinian side. The Israelis say, hey, look, we've been here during the Ottoman period. You purged us out of all of these other Islamic lands when the Ottoman Empire fell. We moved to this land, this Israel, our ancestral land, and we're willing to fight for it. And this is something that the Arabs weren't used to seeing.
Mm-hmm. We have a minute before we go to break. In very short order, how would you say this is a conflict like unlike any other?
In some way, it's the oldest conflict because you're dealing with what the Israelis will call an ancient state. You know, Egypt exists as a state today, and they have ancient Egypt with the pharaohs and all this thing. But who are they in conflict with, right? It's Israel is literally fighting for their own existence, and they have been since 48.
We have to take a short break. We'll be back with my conversation with Bob Cargill, a biblical studies scholar at the University of Iowa. He specializes in ancient Jewish history. We're getting at the roots of the conflict, the war in Gaza, now entering its sixth month. Back in just a moment. It's River to River from IPR News.
Support for IPR comes from Orchestra Iowa, presenting the movie E.T., the Extraterrestrial on the big screen, accompanied by the Symphony Orchestra performing the score live, May 3rd and 4th at 7:30 at the Paramount. Tickets at orchestraiowa.com.
Can we heal the environment? In Kansas, we're working on it. Up From Dust is a podcast about how humans reshaped the world to fit urban landscapes and agricultural needs. We'll meet the people who are rolling up their sleeves to find more sustainable ways forward. Listen to Up From Dust from KCUR, part of the NPR network.
We're back with more of River to River from IPR News. I'm Ben Kiefer. 5 months ago today, October 7th, Hamas launching a surprise attack on southern Israel from the Gaza Strip. Over 1,200 Israelis and foreign nationals killed in that attack, Hamas taking some 250 hostages. And since then, what a horrific humanitarian crisis developing in Gaza. Also, because of the Israeli reaction to eliminate Hamas, over 30,000 Palestinians have died in the conflict, many thousands of them women and children. Back to my conversation earlier today with Bob Cargill, biblical studies scholar specializing in ancient Jewish history at the University of Iowa. Bob, in the remainder of our time here, our few minutes, I wanted to get your thoughts on how this war has affected us here domestically, our culture, our politics here in the United States. And talk about the rise in hate crimes we've seen in this country. What are we seeing now that we haven't seen in this country before that is linked to this conflict?
Well, there's a couple of things taking place at the same time. And one is there has always been, especially in many progressive cities, there has always been a tendency to want to side with the Palestinian cause because it's an underdog cause, or at least it's seen as an underdog cause. They're the ones that are or at this present time, looking for statehood. Israel's got an established state. And again, there was supposed to be, with the Peel Plan and the British Mandate, there was supposed to be an Arab state and an Israeli state. They put that to the UN. The Israelis accepted it. The Arabs did not. Then they went to war, and Israel wound up with a state. And the area that was supposed to be the Palestinian state was basically annexed by Jordan and Egypt. Gaza went to Egypt, and the Jordanians took the – so they didn't get a state. And so Palestinians are still waiting for a state. And so the world thinks, well, that's fair that they should have a state. They got really close with the Oslo Accords, but they're still waiting for the state. So there's this notion that they deserve a state too. Half of Israel, by the way, the ones that were protesting against Netanyahu, my colleagues, who were out there the day before October 7th, they were out there in the streets
because
marching.
Because of the constitutional changes.
Correct. They're no fans of Netanyahu either.
Yeah.
So they were protesting this. They want to see a Palestinian state. But that's the Palestinian side of it. The Israeli side is, how do you make peace when an area of this land, Gaza, is controlled by a group that is sworn in its constitution, in its founding documents, to annihilate the sovereign state of Israel from the river to the sea. So they've tried to make peace with the Palestinians, and people will say, well, that's not fair, and you got to hammer that out in negotiations. But let's not forget that after Arafat died, his party Fatah went to war, a civil war with Hamas over in Gaza. And the result was that Hamas controls Gaza and Fatah controls the West Bank. And so once Hamas had rule of Gaza, Israelis were working much better with the West Bank, with the Palestinian Authority in the West Bank. And Hamas just said, we will never accept Israel. We will never, because that's in their founding documents. They want to kill all of the Jews. And Israelis and the rest of the international world said, we're not going to deal with these terrorists. They define themselves as a resistance movement, as an armed resistance movement. And, you know, when things get out of control, they can't pay, they can't govern. They shoot rockets at civilians. They target civilians. So the Israeli side is, you have to go. We have to get rid of you. You can't be partners in peace if your official position is you want to annihilate our state.
How do you deal with the claim made by some that the atrocities committed by Hamas were a legitimate response in some ways to the oppression as they see it by the Israelis?
I don't accept this. And the reason I don't accept it is it's an armed resistance movement against what? Against a sovereign state? You know, every time Palestinians have tried to take up arms against the Israelis, be it in 48 or 67 or the Yom Kippur War or, you know, pick a war, they're not successful. So you can – and again, it goes back to 48. It goes back to the British Mandate. But the Israelis are saying, look, we've lived here as long as you have, and we were immigrating before this, and we wanted to share this land with you. You're the ones that rejected it, and now you're mad. And you just won't ever take the deal. So you're targeting our civilians. This is the difference. Hamas is targeting surprise attacks, civilians, because they don't consider anyone in the state of Israel to be a civilian. They don't distinguish. Everyone is a combatant. If you are Jewish and living in Israel, you're obviously part of the machine. You're obviously a Zionist, and therefore you're eligible to be killed. Whereas the Israelis, who could just go in and carpet bomb the place, don't. They're a modern civilized state, and so they're actually going in and trying their best. Get out of the way. Here's what we're looking for.
Israelis facing charges of genocide.
Correct, because they've killed a lot of people, 30,000 people, and that's horrific. That should not happen. But let's forget, there's a Syrian civil war that's killed 300,000 Arab civilians, right? 300,000 over the past decade. And yet I'm not seeing marches. I'm not seeing this. The Rohingya Muslims over in Myanmar, in Bangladesh, these they're just there's an actual, honest-to-God genocide going on over there, and most people don't know where the Rakhine State is.
Bob, I wanted to have you react to news from this week. A team of the United Nations experts reported on Monday that there were, quote, reasonable grounds to believe sexual violence, including rape, gang rape, occurred at several locations during this October 7th attack on Israel by Hamas militants. How does that fit in here?
The war, the violence prior to the Arab Israeli war in 48, the Israeli War of Independence, the violence prior to that was horrific. I mean, it was violent. It was nasty. And that was what the British were trying to put down with the partition plan. It has always been like this. To see someone as inhuman, as an unhuman individual, and so this is the enemy, we can do whatever we want to them. That's how Hamas sees these Jews, these Israeli people. And the Israelis are trying to operate on a more modern, you know, they've got the body cams and they're going to be held responsible for anything that they do. But now we're in a situation where nobody trusts anything that's coming out of there. So any report, well, obviously that's Israeli propaganda, or obviously that's Palestinian propaganda. And so you get
even
to
if it comes from the UN.
Yeah. And tell me if this sounds familiar. The news just gets this fake, it's this propaganda. And if you can just flood it with propaganda, then both sides can get away with just about anything.
To finish up here, Bob, where do you see this headed? What are your hopes, your fears?
Anytime a war has broken out, Israel wins. And I don't think that's because of divine providence or anything. Israel's got a massive established military. They've got us backing them. They're always going to win an armed conflict. And so I can see them doing anything from taking control of Gaza and having a military apparatus and letting the Palestinian Arab population back in there. Or I could see them going as far as the other direction, annexing the place and pushing the population into Egypt. I mean, they're tired. Israel is tired of having rockets shot at its civilian population. They've had it. They've tried to live with that and they've had it. If you're a Palestinian living in Gaza, you're being held hostage by Hamas on the one side, a mob, a gang, right, who will kill you if you speak out against Hamas, or you've got these Israelis that are willing to take action against you at any point. If Hamas, who breaks all these international conventions, you know, shooting from hospitals and things, I feel bad for the Palestinian people of Gaza. I've always felt horrible. They've been sold out by their own leaders, and this has been the problem.
Bob Cargill, thank you for this conversation. We'll check back in with you. This conflict is not ending anytime soon, unfortunately. Bob Cargill, biblical studies scholar specializing in ancient Jewish history at the University of Iowa. Thanks for coming in, Bob.
Glad to be here. Thank you.
It's River to River from IPR News. I'm Ben Kiefer. This hour, marking 5 months after the Hamas attack on Israel that sparked the war in Gaza. On Sunday, Vice President Kamala Harris called for an immediate temporary ceasefire in Gaza to facilitate a hostage deal between Israel and Hamas, and pressed Israel to do more to increase the flow of aid to alleviate the immense scale of suffering among Palestinians.
There must be an immediate ceasefire. This will get the hostages out and get a significant amount of aid in. This would allow us to build something more enduring, to ensure Israel is secure, and to respect the right of the Palestinian people to dignity, freedom, and self-determination.
Today on River to River, hearing views of the war from several Iowans. Later, we'll hear from Jerry Sorokin, former head of Hillel at the University of Iowa. Earlier today, I had a chance to speak with Muna. Muna is a Palestinian-American who lives in the Quad Cities. Muna prefers to go by her first name only in this case due to threats to other Palestinian advocates in her community. Muna, welcome to the program.
Hi, Ben. Thank you for having me.
Tell us, first of all, a little bit about your background, your connections to Palestine, how you came to live in Iowa. And I understand your husband is also Palestinian-American.
Yes, yes. I am Palestinian-American. Both my parents are Palestinian-Americans as well. And so is my husband. So we came to the United States in the 90s. My parents grew up in Kuwait and Jordan. Their grandparents grew up in Palestine. My grandparents grew up in Palestine, but were displaced after 1948. My parents came from Jordan directly to the United States. And since then, I've grown up in the Quad Cities my whole life.
Yeah. Tell us a little bit more about your grandparents and their displacement. Why did they feel they had to leave?
They didn't feel that they had to leave. They were forcibly displaced. So after 1948, 750,000 Palestinians were forced to leave their homes. Many of them went to neighboring countries. So they assumed that they would be returning, and a lot of them took with them their home keys. But 75 years later, they have not been able to return.
Mm-hmm. Let's move to October 7th of last year and its immediate aftermath. What was that like for you, your reaction to the news of the surprise attack by Hamas?
Yeah, I mean, like every other American and Palestinian, shocked, of course, and kind of consistently following the news to see new updates on what exactly happened and why and, you know, all of that. So I would say shock. And as an American, you know, growing up and being Palestinian, I have a little bit of background of knowing a little bit of the historical and context of the situation there. So I kind of always knew that there was always tension brewing in that region. So, you know, these attacks, are sad and disheartening. I as a Muslim, you know, my values and upbringing condone any form of terrorism and the killing of anyone innocent. So that was my first reaction.
Yeah. Just to be clear here, your view of Hamas's view here, Hamas thinks this was a legitimate response to the grievances of the Palestinian people. You sound like you do not share that view.
I actually am not a Hamas supporter or, you know, a supporter of any group that uses any sort of violence against innocent civilians. I am just, you know, pro the people and the citizens and citizens of Palestine, Palestinians and the civilians in Gaza. So myself and my family and close friends all condemn any acts of violence towards anybody, any innocent civilian. So, I hope that answers your question.
Mm-hmm. And you feel in your wider circle of family, Palestinians you have contact with, Palestinian Americans, is it more or less that they feel the same way?
Yes. So any Palestinian American who has morals and values will tell you that they condemn the killing of anyone innocent. It's just something that it should be universal if you have any decency. And so I condemn the killing of anyone innocent. And currently, you know, that's happening in Gaza. 40,000 civilians have been killed, 70% of them women and children.
What are you hearing from friends and relatives in Gaza?
So I don't have immediate friends and family in Gaza. I have distant relatives in the West Bank, so the Palestinian occupied territories. There's always been tension in the West Bank. So in before October 7th, so in 2023, it was the deadliest year for Palestinians. You had over 243 Palestinians killed in the West Bank. So there's always been tension in the area. There's always been killing of Palestinians and injustice. And so this is something that's been happening since 1948. It's something that is just commonly heard of. A Palestinian getting shot in the street is just something that commonly occurs in the West Bank, unfortunately. So, it's unfortunate and disheartening and the reality of the situation. And, you know, our hope is that one day, you know, Palestinians have, freedom and their human rights and that, you know, everyone in that region can live in peace together.
Comment on the calls for a ceasefire. We played Vice President Kamala Harris there. What do you think of the approach here to get a ceasefire for at least 6 weeks and the release of hostages?
I mean, I don't consider a ceasefire something that's temporary. So, you know, I think Palestinians and local Americans are calling for a permanent ceasefire. So 6 weeks is not going to cut it. You don't get to stop killing children and then resume in 6 weeks. You don't get to drop aid from the sky and then fund Israel to bomb and massacre civilians. It's not how it works.
Mm-hmm. We have to take a break in just a moment, but briefly, what kind of discussions have you had with Iowans about the war, its causes, over the past 5 months?
We've had a lot of discussions. We've actually had many rallies and protests in the Quad Cities, probably the first ever. I mean, I've grown up my whole life here, and so you never saw this many people coming out. And so we are anticipating this next upcoming one on Saturday at LeClaire Park and Bandshell that we're going to be getting over hundreds of people and of very diverse ethnicities, backgrounds, religious backgrounds. We have many Jews that come out and support the end of this genocide and are calling for a ceasefire. So we've had a lot of discussions with people of various faiths and backgrounds.
Muna, sorry to interrupt. We have to take a short break. Muna is a Palestinian American from the Quad Cities. Back with more of my discussion with her. It's River to River from IPR News.
Can we heal the environment? In Kansas, we're working on it. Up From Dust is a podcast about how humans reshaped the world to fit urban landscapes and agricultural needs. We'll meet the people who are rolling up their sleeves to find more sustainable ways forward. Listen to Up From Dust from KCUR, part of the NPR network.
Back with more River to River from IPR News. I'm Ben Kiefer, hearing views of the war from several Iowans this hour. Let's get back to my conversation earlier today with Muna, Palestinian-American who lives in the Quad Cities, prefers to go by her first name only due to threats to other Palestinian advocates in the community. Muna, before the break, we were talking about discussions you've had with Iowans. I wanted to get at that. What are the most contentious points you find when you're talking with Iowans about this war? Because, of course, it has shaped our politics, our culture here in the U.S. Greatly.
Yeah, a lot of the points that we discuss is, our role as a government and a country in this war and how much we're funding it with our tax money. And so that's been a huge reason why we are going out and protesting. Part of the reason is because, you know, this is our tax money and it shouldn't go to funding genocide. And so that's been a major, topic. Mainly how to approach people who, may have a strong opinion, one way or another, and how to go about educating the general community and public about the Israeli-Palestinian conflict and the history of it and how we have gotten to this point. And yeah. So those two main topics have been, points of discussion within our community. And we formed a Quad Cities for Palestine Coalition Facebook, Instagram page with many, many participants who are, eager to volunteer and spread and educate.
Yeah, we only have about a minute left. We want to divide the time equally with our other guest this hour. Mm-hmm. But you've used the word genocide several times. Of course, many Israelis would take issue with that. What about the Israeli side of this? They feel they're under an existential threat and they are trying to root out Hamas, who is committed to eliminating Israel as a state and the Israelis as a people.
Well, I have to say this. Again, there is a lot of history to this regional conflict. Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu has stated several times that he would like to completely demolish all of Gaza and the civilians and completely, displace all Palestinians. So it could go either way. You know, we can kind of play this game back and forth of, they said this, oh, they said that. At the end of the day, it's the civilians that are suffering and the civilians in Gaza currently that are suffering and the children that are starving. And so there needs to be a ceasefire. And before we can begin to talk about what happens going forward, there needs to be an end to the genocide taking place. And it is a genocide, and I will not be apologetic for calling it that.
Mm-hmm. In the last minute here, what are your fears for the people of Gaza? What are your hopes for the future of that region?
Well, my current hopes is that there will be a ceasefire, a permanent one, that humanitarian aid will enter Gaza, especially to the north where there are children starving. In the future, I hope and pray that there is peace in the region for both sides, and that we can all, you know, one day live together peacefully, and Palestinians have their human rights and dignity in that country and land, and that the ones that were displaced have a right to return to their land.
Okay. I want to thank you very much for the courage of talking with us.
Thank you for having me.
Muna, a Palestinian American living in the Quad Cities, thank you very much for sharing your views with IPR listeners today, Muna. Take care.
Thank you. I appreciate it. Thanks, Ben. Bye.
Bye now. That conversation recorded earlier today. Our focus, the Israel-Hamas war, 5 months to the day after the surprise attack on Israel. Last week, thousands of protesters led by families of hostages seized by Palestinian militants marched on the streets of Jerusalem demanding their release. Reuters spoke with some of these protesters.
We are here marching in support of the families of those who have been kidnapped, wishing that they will be released soon and be safe, and we're praying for them and every step that we're taking.
I'm here also because I think that all the rest that the government is saying is a lie. We cannot stop the Hamas. We cannot finish their regime. We cannot take power again. Israel cannot go back into to Gaza and occupy the Palestinians there. We need to find a solution.
Protesters in the streets of Jerusalem gathered by Reuters news agency. This hour, we've been hearing several views on this five-month-long war in Gaza. Earlier, a biblical studies scholar at the UI, just a moment ago from a Palestinian-American living in the Quad Cities. We're joined now by Jerry Sorokin. Jerry Sorokin is executive director at Beth Israel Congregation in Ann Arbor, Michigan. Until recently, Jerry, a longtime resident of Iowa City, former head of Hillel at the University of Iowa. Jerry, are you there?
Yes, good to hear from you, Ben.
Good to hear from you. Let's get into it with our limited time. How do you view this war and what's at stake?
This war is a terrible tragedy for everybody. The Israeli people went through a traumatic experience on October 7th, unlike anything that they had experienced in at least 50 years. People who were attacked, who were murdered, who were the subject of sexual violence, and in many cases, who were taken as hostage. That's an experience of violation that nobody remembered going back as far as 1973 or even earlier. Meanwhile, the response that the Israeli government and military have taken to try to root out Hamas and destroy their ability to harm Israelis has imposed terrible costs on the Palestinian people living in Gaza. And it's tragic for everybody involved on both sides to see this level of death and destruction that both Israelis and Palestinians have experienced in recent months.
The Israeli government, military, obviously thought the actions they've taken in the past 5 months were necessary. You see an alternative path. Other Jewish Americans, Israelis, would have wished for a different path than demolishing most of Gaza.
Well, I think most of us agree that we wish this wasn't perceived as necessary. I'm not party to the discussions and the intelligence that the Israeli military is using in order to make their choices about what to target and how to proceed with this war. I think there's still a general consensus that Hamas has done nothing but harm to both Israel and the Palestinians, to the Middle East region more generally, and that it's totally understandable that the Israelis have taken action to try to disarm Hamas and take them out of power. But at the same time, I think we have to recognize that the Israeli government does not make decisions reflecting the preferences of the entire Israeli people. From the time that Prime Minister Netanyahu took office until literally the day before the war, there were mass protests in Israel every week of tens and hundreds of thousands of people who were opposed to the anti-democratic moves that the government was making within Israel proper. They were opposed to the support that the Israeli government was offering to the West Bank settlers. And so those views have not really changed. I think that for a lot of Israelis and a lot of friends of Israel outside of the country, those are right now less urgent issues than the need to try to rescue the hostages and eliminate the military threat from Gaza. But those issues do remain as a major concern for a lot of people.
Jerry, we just heard from a Palestinian American from the Quad Cities. She says she condemns all violence and killing in this war, but also makes no apologies for calling the actions of the IDF, the Israeli Defense Force, an act of genocide. Your reaction to the use of that?
I think that that's an irresponsible use of a term. Genocide is used to describe events like Turkey's targeting of Armenians during World War I, or the conflict in Rwanda in the 1990s, and of course, as we know, the Nazi Holocaust against the Jews and other targets in World War II, where the point of the policy was to kill civilians. The goal was to rid the other community of living beings. I would think that any Israeli, and I know that any supporter of Israel outside of Israel, is just terribly heartbroken by the level of destruction and the deaths that have occurred within Gaza. Nobody in the Jewish community is celebrating those deaths. If it were a genocide, there would be parties. There would be glee at the results of the Israeli military destruction. And that's not the case. It's not a genocide. It was never intended to be a genocide. The goal of Israeli policy is not to kill as many Palestinians as possible. It is to make it impossible for Hamas to continue to operate within Gaza and threaten Israel. We can quibble and argue about the effectiveness of Israel's strategy, about the validity of that goal, but it is not genocide.
Jerry, as a Jewish American, a longtime former resident of Iowa, now in Ann Arbor, Michigan, there at Beth Israel Congregation, how has this war changed the climate for you as a Jew living in an American? What have been some of the discussions among fellow American Jews that you've had that you would like to bring to light?
One thing that a lot of us have experienced is a feeling of indifference from our friends from outside the Jewish community. There's a lot of sense that the Jewish people have been supportive of progressive causes, have been supportive of other minority communities in the United States and around the world, and continue to support those goals. But yet, through the process of, I think, exaggerated descriptions or misinterpretations of what's going on in the Middle East, many Jews are feeling like they're being abandoned by their friends. That the notion that the October 7th attack was a traumatic experience for everybody is just not resonating within the general community, including in organizations that a lot of Jewish people have been active in for many, many years. Here at our synagogue in Ann Arbor, where I work, we have had protesters who line up outside our building every Saturday morning. And this has been going on literally for 20 years, protesting both Israeli policy and some descriptions of Jewish control of the media, Jewish control of the banking system. It's all the classic anti-Semitic tropes. And we've been dealing with that, thinking that at least our protesters are a very small fringe group that want to make sure that they make their presence known to Jewish people entering the synagogue every week. But I think more recently, a lot of people have been looking at them and saying, well, maybe they have a point. Mm-hmm. And the truth is they don't have a point. To put up signs saying things like, no more Holocaust movies, or money for Americans, not for Israel, or whatever it is that they're protesting, is deeply insulting and hurtful to the Jewish people of Ann Arbor, but I think it's also being seen in other parts of the country.
Jerry, what do you see as the implications for the Jewish community if Israel loses the support of the international community? We're seeing a waning of support here in the U.S. I'm sure you're aware of that. What are the implications, your fears there?
Well, I think right now there's still a confidence that the Biden administration is ultimately on Israel's side. They recognize the necessity of a stable Israeli democratic friend for the United States in the region. And even if the election in the fall here changes the administration, it's, I think, safe to expect that the United States will continue to be supportive of Israel, even in the face of growing opposition from other countries around the world. The UN has been consistent in singling out Israel and targeting it for differential treatment. And this goes back 75 years, where if you look at the number of resolutions that the UN Security Council adopts in criticizing other countries, Israel is far and away the largest target of Security Council condemnations and of condemnations from human rights organizations affiliated with the UN. That's nothing new for the Israelis, and it's nothing new for the Jewish community. We recognize that much of the rest of the world tends to blame Israel first, and in some cases blame the Jews for being supportive of Israel. I think that we have to continue to deal with that, recognizing that all life is sacred and that we have to be supportive of policies that will lead to the resolution of this war and the ultimate resolution of the conflict. But at the same time, we don't apologize for who we are, for Jewish people being connected to the ancestral homeland, and for Israelis having every right to live in peace and dignity that their Palestinian and other Arab neighbors have.
Jerry, really only 30 seconds, sorry for the short time on this response. Why do you think that younger age groups in the U.S. seem to be more sympathetic to the Palestinian cause?
That's a good question. And I think part of it is because the longer the time, the more time passes since the end of World War II, since the establishment of Israel, since the wars with Israel's neighbors, the more Israel is perceived as merely a big military bully rather than a small country in a region of great instability. When I was growing up many years ago, it was understood that Israel was the underdog, but militarily they're not, and I think politically they're perceived by them not to be also.
Jerry Sorokin, thank you very much. Executive Director at Beth Israel Congregation in Ann Arbor, Michigan, former resident of Iowa. Jerry, nice to hear from you.
Thanks, Ben.
Today's program produced by Caitlin Troutman and Danny Gear with help from Catherine Perkins. Tomorrow it's a NewsBuzz edition of our program. Robin Upsall of Iowa Capitol Dispatch on activity at the State House. Brianne Fannensteel of the Des Moines Register on a new series of Iowa polls. Also our own Sheila Brummer on a Western Iowa school district at the center of an assault investigation involving its high school wrestling team. That's when we return tomorrow on River to River.